So at the center of our community, our meditative community, is and our community is very poorly defined. It's basically anyone who wants to be part of it. It's basically anybody in the world. This community is the practice of mindfulness. And there's various ways of approaching mindfulness practice. And the common way for people, especially if they're new to the practice, is to look at mindfulness practice as something which will support their normal life, their regular life. They'll look at mindfulness practice, how is it going to help me in my life? And so they'll add mindfulness practice as a support to coping better in their life, having less stress, getting along better with other people, other beings. Seen as a support for their life. Another way of looking at mindfulness practice is to turn it around. And rather than seeing mindfulness practice as a support for your life, is to think of your life as a support for mindfulness practice. And the latter approach, I think, is the approach taken when mindfulness is part of someone's spiritual life. Spiritual life is, after all, first of all, a life. It's a way of living. And so the question then is, how can I use my life to support the mindfulness practice? In order to have that kind of approach, I think a person has the power and the importance of mindfulness or of awareness or of freedom, the kind of freedom or awakening that can come when mindfulness is mature. Otherwise, the tremendous momentum we have of wanting our life to support us, wanting our life to somehow build up a sense of self or create a healthier sense of self or whatever, going to be paramount. A common, approach for some people would be, what's in it for me? And perhaps, in a kind of innocent way, that's an attitude, what's in it for me? But that attitude, what's in it for me, can get mixed up very quickly with attitudes of conceit, of arrogance, of egocentric approaches to the I. And in mindfulness practice, in Buddhist practice, is meant to be a cure to the illness of conceit, of arrogance, of self-centeredness. At some point, people of practice, I think, begins feeling maybe there's a shift from how is mindfulness going to support my life to how is my life going to support mine. And I mentioned this in the Thursday class this week, and someone then asked me to explain further. And so I came up with this example, which is a rather kind of maybe a trifling example, but you can hopefully expand it to the rest of your life. Someone who uses mindfulness to support their life maybe likes to drive really fast, drive around town kind of careening around the corners and racing through yellow lights. And it's kind of a dangerous lifestyle to be racing around in their car. So they want to do it safer. They want to be more safer, more competent in racing around town. So they adopted mindfulness practice, which will develop their mindfulness, and they stay a little bit more calmer as they're racing around. But they still race around, and the mindfulness helps them become better racers. Another approach, the other approach is, how does mindfulness support my life? Would be my life support? Would be okay. Let me look at how I drive my car. And how can I drive my car in such a way that it supports my presence, my developing of mindfulness, how to support a greater clarity and presence in my life? And so then a person reevaluates how they drive and say, wait a minute, I'll drive a little bit slower than I usually do. When I'm always racing around, I'm actually not so present. I'm present for certain kinds of things. But it actually leaves me kind of tense to always be kind of be ahead of myself and driving that way. And being tense is not very conducive overall to developing a mindful life. So why don't I slow down a little bit and drive in such a way that I'm more likely to be present and calm than still racing with that momentum of having, you know, a speeded around. So how do we live our life so it supports awareness, so it supports presence, so it supports mindfulness? Now, in saying it that way, mindfulness, presence, awareness, there's no, in and of itself, no reference to the I, to me. It isn't how does it support my awareness, my presence. We could say that, and you could certainly say it in an innocent way. But I chose not to say it that way. How does it support awareness, presence, freedom, mindfulness, without the pronoun to go with it? And one of the important functions of mindfulness practice is to ferret out, to highlight for us how conceptions of self, how I-making, how creation of conceit, how referring everything of me, I'm the one who's doing things, gets in the way of our freedom of awareness. Your eyes, when your eyes look, when your eyes see, your eyes don't see themselves. And the eyes are taken up with all the objects of what it sees. But the eyes in themselves don't see themselves. And the eyes don't think, you know, oh, I am the one who's seeing here. It's possible to have mindfulness that's kind of like that. That mindfulness self-functions, but the mindfulness doesn't with the idea, oh, I'm the one who's mindful. Of course, in an innocent way, it's fine to say that. It's a reasonable thing to say, you know, I am mindful. But as soon as we use the word I, oftentimes, it's a magnet for all kinds of other associations and ideas and emotions and feelings. And part of the function of mindfulness is to really highlight these, what gets adhered to around this idea of I, of me. Because as we sit in mindfulness, there's a tendency for the mind to become simpler, for the eyes that see to become clearer and clearer. And then the filter of ideas of who I am, the filters of judging and evaluating myself and what I'm doing and comparing myself to others begins to abate a little bit and quiet. And sometimes it can happen quite much. You can get very still and very quiet. And compared to our normal life, very little I-making and me-making, mind-making is operating. And a person's kind of very simply present. And then it's very easy, very important then, as you leave meditation, to pay careful attention to how we reconstruct this sense of I and me and mine, because it'll start reappearing. And as we pay attention to it, to pay attention to whether it feels easeful or whether it feels tense, to pay attention to whether it feels contracted, whether it has suffering or stress in the conception of I am, me making, mind making, and all that, or whether it's free of that. So it's very simple. I mean, you can really see it very clearly sometimes coming out of meditation if you pay attention. Most of you can pay attention today. Most of you took off your shoes before you came sit down, and those of you who are sitting in chairs, many of you took off your shoes because it seems like, you know, it's our custom to do so. But I'm conscious that then your feet are on the cold linoleum. So if you're sitting on the chair and you come to sit with us, it's okay to have your shoes on if the cold bothers you. But anyway, most of you put your shoes out outside, you know, or in the back. And when it's time for us all to leave, and we all leave with different shoes than we came with, our shoes wouldn't care. Cares. The caring doesn't exist in the shoes themselves. The idea of ownership and possession doesn't exist in the shoes themselves, but it's a creation of the mind. It's an addition to the mind. Suzuki Roshi, when there's a famous picture of him holding his glasses like this, And the glasses were, those, that picture was taken just as and when he gave a very famous little teaching. And he said, "These glasses are not my glasses. But you know about my poor, tired, old eyes, so you let me use them." I thought it was a very sweet way of looking at it. You know, he didn't say he didn't have this contraction or this holding on. This is mine, and it can be done in an innocent way to possession. But often the ideas of possession, this is mine, come along with a whole series of other associated attitudes and clingings and ideas, fears, ambitions, and things. And Suzuki Roshi was, I think, in part saying he wasn't bringing along such complicated associations to his glasses. He was saying, you know, basically these belong to you, but you know about my eyes, so you let me use them. So the movement from meditation up into our life, back into our normal life, if you pay attention, you begin seeing how we construct and create self-identity, how we create a sense of possession, me and mine, and how we begin comparing ourselves to others. We get up from meditation, perhaps, and our mind is very quiet and very still, and all that's not working so much. And we go into a room full of people, and all those people have small noses, and you have a big nose. And suddenly, you feel, uh-oh, I don't belong here. But then the next day, you get up from meditation, you go into a room full of people with big noses, and you still have a big nose, and you don't have those thoughts. And you have no thoughts about me and who I am in relationship to other people based on my nose. So it's a doing of the mind. It's a creation of me and mine, comparative thinking that comes into play. And it's possible to watch that and track that, and in tracking it, become freer of it. And that's a very important function of mindfulness. It works in the other direction also. If you go from kind of street consciousness, street awareness, and you're going into your meditation, and the mind gets quieter and simpler, at some point, as the mind gets quieter and simpler, what you'll notice is occasionally, maybe, the creation of this is who I am, creation of comparative thinking, creation of possessiveness, or what does this mean for me? And if your mind is sensitive enough, then not only will you notice these kinds of functionings of the mind, but you'll also notice the cost of that. You'll notice that it actually entails a certain degree of stress, of suffering, of tightness, of discomfort, of agitation, to have that kind of concern in your mind. And so then, look, I-making, me-making, we see a different aspect to it than simply, well, I'm going to justification of whether I exist or should exist this way or whatever. But you actually see much more basically, you question, hopefully much more basically, is it worth this cost? Is it worth having this agitation of thinking about myself in this way? Or should I let go of that kind of self-concern in favor of dropping into a stiller place, into the quieter place, into a place of less attachment? And again, kind of like the analogy of the eyes, if you're concerned about, who you are seeing, and how other people notice how well you see, that actually will get in the way of your seeing. If you want your seeing to function freely, hopefully there's no concern about or thoughts about seeing itself. You're just seeing freely. And then as mind settles, hopefully what will happen to people, they learn that it's possible to be alive without me-making, I-making, mind-making. That it's possible to be alive without the comparative thinking that arises when we compare myself to others and other ideas and values and judgments. And to have this experience of self, or to have the experience of oneself, without the incessant kind of bombardment of me making and my making, is a tremendous relief and gives many people a sense that there's an alternative way of living. That is not a matter because are constantly concerned about themselves. And to some degree, you know, growing up, it's normal, perhaps. And I was reminded recently about things, poems that I wrote and concerns I had when I was 18, 19, and 20. And they were so caught up with issues of self. And maybe that was appropriate to some degree at that age. But what I learned in my meditation practice, my Buddhist practice, is there's a place within me or a place that exists where I neither have to construct any kind of sense of self, nor do I have to compare myself to any. This there, without any filter, any of self-concept at all. So that becomes a radical alternative to the way most people live. Most people don't know about that as an alternative. Most people take their my-making and I-making, the manufacture of self-concept, as a given. Of course, that's the way the universe is made. It's kind of like the air we breathe, we don't see it. But deep meditation actually shows us that that's actually only one way to live, and there are alternatives, and the alternatives are much more peaceful. So the notion of conceit in Buddhism is a very... Conceit is understood to be a creation that we add on top of who we are, what the situation is. And conceit is understood to be... It's also very different than how it's understood often in the West. In the West, conceit is understood usually as being a delusion of superiority. I'm better than others, a kind of arrogance. In Buddhism... conceit is understood, the word is mana in Pali. The conceit is understood to be any kind of conception, conceptualizing self in comparison to others. And so it includes thinking you're better than others, but it also includes thinking that you're worse than others. And it also includes the great American conception that you're equal to others. And all those three are considered to be kind of delusions, that you're better, worse, or equal to others. Now, the first two maybe you're willing to kind of accept, but the third, shouldn't I be equal to everyone else? I mean, that's the great, isn't Buddhism kind of helping to equalize everyone? And oh, are we getting cold? Are people getting cold? Should we turn on the heater and deal with the sound, or you okay? Okay. The great equalizer. But the idea is not that. So, what's the alternative to thinking of yourself neither as better, worse, or equal? And the alternative is that don't compare yourself at all. That's the alternative. It isn't that maybe you can. If you want to think about it, of course, it's a good idea to think of that you're equal in some ways. But what ways? I'm better than some of you. Absolutely. And some of you, I think, are better than me. And some of you, I think, are equal to me. I mean, that's just a kind of fact of life. I mean, you know, it's not like, I'm not arrogant about it, I hope. But it just, you know, that's, I'm not going to, but what does it mean when we say we're equal to someone? What's the criteria, or everyone's equal? What's the criteria for that? The suggestion in Buddhism is that maybe... To be careful with any kind of comparative thinking, and perhaps in not creating any conception of better, worse, or equal to, that's actually the ultimate equalizer. That's actually what allows people to meet each other as they actually are. There's a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon from many years ago. Well, Calvin stands underneath the night sky, and he, you know, as, you know, maybe standing there in awe at existence, you know, who are we in the context of this vast intergalactic swirl of activity that we are part of? And so he stands there looking at the stars, and he says, he raises his hands up and he yells confidence, and he says, I am significant. Looking at the stars. And then the next panel, he says very quietly and subtly, says the dust mote to the stars. And one is this, what is kind of a, maybe a delusion of grandeur, and the other is the illusion of the opposite, of insignificance. And Buddhism says neither. You need to, it's possible to operate with neither. You neither have to think of yourself as worth or better than. The implications of this is very interesting. A lot of people are shy. Some people are shy. And from the Buddhist analysis of shyness, is understood to be a function of conceit, a function of having, of being concerned about your self-image and how people see you. And the stronger the shyness, the stronger is the conceit. The stronger sense of self is you have, you're protecting or hiding or whatever. And so sometimes people who are shy will defend their shyness because they say, oh, my shyness is, you know, I don't know what, I had a hard life. And so, but shyness is understood to be a kind of conceit. So Buddhism, Buddhist practice, mindfulness practice, can be understood as a way of life. And as a way of life, it actually becomes threatening to the functioning of conceit, the functioning of arrogance, the functioning of kind of possessiveness that maybe isn't inherent in our self-nature and in the depths of who we are and our freedom. And part of the functioning of mindfulness is to really clarify and highlight this works in our lives so that we become freer. Maybe that's enough. The we have quite a bit of time now, so if you would like to respond or have questions, I hear your reactions to this. Please.
When we say we're equal equal opportunity or equal rights, and isn't that a function of freedom rather than egotism?
Yeah, we have to be aware of the domain of the discourse we're using, and certain ways of speaking are appropriate at certain domains. So, for example, an enlightened person will use the word I. If the enlightened person, someone asks someone, you know, enlightened person, what's your age? The person, well, I am, when they'll say their age, and they're not. If you're engaged in political discussions and have to deal with political issues or decision making, then looking at the questions of the political nature of self, the relational nature of self, who we are in relationship to others, and I think it's fine to come to conclusions like, you know, we're all equal. We're all equal in the eyes of God. Is the great, isn't that kind of like what we're supposed to say in America? So that's in kind of a, so certain domain of discussion, language, but in a different domain of discussion, and this is part of the problem when people talk about self and not self in Buddhism and these kinds of things, is there's often different domains of language, different references, and so we have to be able to be flexible and understand what we're talking about at different times. So, but for me to say, we're all equal, and I'm equal to you in playing as a basketball player, and who I'm playing with is the Chicago something or other Warriors, no, Chicago Bulls. And insist on my equality, the Chicago Bulls, kind of border on maybe conceit. you know, it's going to cause a lot of problems for people, including that team when I join them. So what I'm trying to point to is that to insist on our equality can, in certain circumstances, be problematic and be a source of clinging to self. In other discourses, it's not. The function of mindfulness is, if you can pay very careful attention to what goes on inside of you as you make these different kinds of statements, you can notice when there's contraction, when there's fear, when there's some kind of suffering that's part of that. And the practice is not necessarily going to stop you from making certain kinds of statements, but it's certainly going to highlight with the motivations inside of you for making those statements. And as you begin purifying yourself of certain motivations which cause you stress, then maybe some statements you're less inclined to make. So is that to respond at all? Is it a satisfying answer?
Very satisfying.
Yeah, please.
I'd like to hear you expand mindfulness in terms of nature and of other sentient beings, so that the focus isn't entirely on humanity, because that's such a central part of Dharma.
So I think it'd be nice to hear a little bit more from you. What you're meaning by this?
I don't like to hear Dharma just appropriate in terms of mindfulness to how humanity thinks of itself.
Yes.
Or we as individuals.
Yeah.
I like to hear about the connections to nature and to other beings, other non-human beings.
Uh-huh.
So mindfulness extends to thinking about the worm and the squirrel. And the food we eat, and where our air and water come from, and our connection with life, and that's mindfulness, so that we are not just in our existence, but everything that supports our existence, which is human and non-human, is part of the awareness of mindfulness.
Wonderful. I don't think I could have said it as well as you said it. So thank you for expanding on that. Yes.
Following that up in the connection of your discussion about conceit and the most difficult part of that, which is equality, I was thinking exactly what you were, that it's easy to confuse being interconnected. And I think you talked about the conceit of shyness, and I was reminded of the Odyssey and Odysseus is trying to make his way home, and there's this one very stark statement in which it's very prescriptive, in which there's, among all these very complicated, loaded sentences, there's this sentence that says, "To be shy and homeless is bad."
Please.
May I tell a joke?
Sure.
I heard this story from kind of practices Islam, but it's actually about some rabbis. And the story goes, people have heard it before. Sure, the story goes that it comes twilight and it's time to say evening prayers, and the rabbi steps outside of the temple to be in the presence of the universe and the stars above. And he can't, prayers, his davening. And he's praying and he's saying, in the presence of the universe, I am nothing. I'm nothing. I'm so small. I'm worthless. I'm inconsequential. Only you are great. And he's praying. A couple of minutes later, a second rabbi comes to the same courtyard and takes his corner and begins to pray and saying very similar things. And now there are two voices in the garden crying how they are nothing and they are inconsequential. Finally, a third presence enters the garden, and it's the janitor, the maintenance man, and He sees what's going on, and he looks at the sky, and he too begins to cry out, I am inconsequential, I am no one, I'm nothing, I'm worthless, only God is great. Both rabbis stop. One looks at the other and he says, who could think he's nobody?
Yeah. It gets very subtle. And and what you find in the discourses of the Buddha is you find some jokes there too. But anyway, I won't go into that now. But there's conceit, and there's also any attempt to make something the I making. And the Buddha pointed to a number of different areas where he claimed was kind of a delusional way of saying this is who I am. And one of them is just to the idea, I am nothing. And to want to be nothing, to want to kind of not exist and not have an identity, is considered to be a form of clinging. But to want to be someone is also, you know, understood to be a form of delusion. But there's many ways that people want to be something or to claim identity for the self. And one of them some of them are quite grand, including I am the universe, I am the cosmos, I am everything, is also considered a problem. And the analogy, again, maybe is a little bit like the I. You know, the I doesn't see itself, doesn't think about itself, it just sees. And when the filter, the one who's seeing or, you know, whatever, come into play, then maybe we don't see as clearly. But when the eyes are functioning clearly without any filters of conceit or arrogance or self-making over them, then it sees the world clearly for what it is. And so part of the function of penetrating or dropping below conceit and arrogance and I-making and my-making is so that we can see the world clearly for what it is. But as soon as we get involved in saying, then, oh, I am the world, then we've actually removed ourselves a little bit. So the question of, you know, our relationship to nature becomes the mindfulness of nature is not a matter of thinking about nature, but is a matter of seeing it more and more clearly when the various veils of illusion begin falling away. And I think anyone who has the veils of illusion fall away will become much more sensitive to the rest of the world. Yes?
One question. I know that the comparison with other people or whatever, to company compare or to people compare, is cause a lot of bad, you know, results. But on the other hand, that people always say, no, I want to do, if I do the thing, I want the best, you know. Then if without that, see, like if it's a company, they say, oh, our product
the best product, you know, then
the
whole society will not move. I think that's one of the energy to make things move. Uh-huh. So I just confused with that. So think of that. So maybe repeat the question. The question is, if we're not concerned about doing the best, if we just let kind of just do things without any concern of better or worse, then society will fall apart, because society really progresses when everyone's trying to do their very best. That could well be. I don't feel like, you know, this is, you know, basically. But there's a difference between doing our best, you know, being that I'm going to do my best when I play basketball. But there's a difference between playing the best basketball and being the best basketball player.
If you don't have the will to be the best player, you probably didn't make your best effort.
Well, I don't know if that's true. It's possible. I mean, in some domains, it's the most ambitious people who maybe go the furthest. Sometimes, you know, if Napoleon hadn't wanted to be the best dictator, driven by that. I mean, Napoleon was a phenomenally driven man, and he hardly slept. He exhausted, apparently, people all around him because he was so determined. And probably there are certain areas where, unless egotism is working, probably certain things would never happen in the world. Like, you probably wouldn't have dictators. So, it's true that some things maybe wouldn't happen if there wasn't the ego working there, kind of nudging it on. But what I find often happens is people often defend all kinds of tendencies within us because they want to see an action in the world, not knowing there can be other motivations for getting things done. So, in order to do your best, that doesn't have to be the motivation of becoming the best person, right? I can want to become the best basketball player and make sure that I get all the rewards, so that it says something about me, or I can be concerned about doing the best I can, without any reference to who I'm the one doing, because I love the love of the game. An artist can, for example, can do really good art and work hard and hard and hard because conceit's involved. I want to be the best artist. Another artist can do their best because they're just determined to get out of the way of their creativity. And so they're trying to do the best, not because of being self-serving, but really serving the art itself. So I don't think I explained it very well, but please.
Yeah, it brings up a lot of interesting thoughts. I think the agreed upon is that if you want to be the best, it's really best to always think that you're the second best. And the thing is that if you really want to be the best, it's always good to think you're the second best. Because once you're the best, there's only one place to go, and that's down. You'll never improve. I mean, being the best is a very permanent thing.
This is the Avis approach.
Well, no, yeah. In the valley with Cisco. I mean, Cisco's number one, but Juniper's really giving Cisco a run for their money, and they're building like crazy. The stock is doing much better, and you can only be number one. I mean, I remember when 90% of the computers were Apple's. And also, I remember when Beaumont Brain was the number one calculator. That company went out of business after 6 months after being on top. So it's a very transitory thing, being number one. So I would want to make that a life's goal.
Please.
Are comparisons to oneself as problematic as comparisons to others?
Explain that a little bit further. Comparison to others, meaning?
If I'm comparing my own effort to my own previous effort, that is problematic as comparing my own effort to someone else.
I don't feel like it's me to answer the question. I mean, it's a very good question. So, but I think it's a question that has to be answered in particular situations. And rather than a general answer comparing those two ways, but rather for you to look in different situations, in the particulars, to answer the question in the particular rather than... Does it make sense? My non-answer, does it make sense?
Perhaps maybe I can give you this.
Sure.
So if I'm trying to be the best I can be, and comparing my performance in this instance to my performance on a previous instance, is that
not necessarily attachment? It can be. I mean, I think it's to some degree it's completely normal to compare what we've done, but comparative thinking is completely normal activity, comparing oneself to what we've done in the past, we learn a lot from that. It's useful often. And comparing yourself to others is also very useful at times. But it can also be a source of tremendous suffering. And it can be a source of delusion, it can be a source of conceit. It isn't that comparative thinking in and of itself is conceit or is conceit. It's what we do with that comparative thinking. It's the fuel. It can be the food for something else. But we have to go through life doing some degree of comparative thought, comparative thinking, you know, otherwise, you know, I mean, comparisons are valid. Some comparisons are valid. And being able to do to differentiate clearly is part of what mindfulness is about. If we can't differentiate clearly and see what's actually going on, then we don't know what's going on. But we have to really be a little become wiser about what we do with that comparative thoughts and when our comparisons are valid even. I mean, sometimes we make comparisons that there's a fallacy. You know, so I saw someone over here first.
Well, I was just thinking about, as I listened to all of this, the sense of there's an implication that motivation comes from something, I don't know quite how to give the words, but I guess what I'm saying is that it seems that, like, to say the best is a relative term. Like, to say best, one automatically is comparing. And that some motivation within oneself, then it seems to me that progress can still occur if that motivation, it doesn't have to be about comparing to, for example, what this woman said,
right,
product, but it can be, that good things can happen as a result of just an inner motivation that exists within equanimity and within the
things you're talking about. So that was the only thing I was thinking about. Yeah. Somehow
we don't need to compare to
other
wonderful things, whether it be products or experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So now I saw
her
hands over here. No?
I think on what you just said, I think it takes faith. Like, I've always been in the habit of using comparison in a negative way to motivate myself. You know, well, I'm not as good as, well, that's, you know, as good as I want to be. And it takes a certain level of faith to say, I will try, even if I'm not doing that. And that's...
Yes?
Well, I've always been a very judgmental. I slice things up and decide what I think is okay and so on. And one of the ways in my life that I've understood this sort of universal encouragement of all spiritual systems away from judgment towards acceptance is that I understand that actually morality or judgment is simply not relevant to reality. However, it is a feature of humanity. It just so happens that's the kind of organism that we are.
Uh-huh.
It's a feature. And that gives a certain perspective. In other words, you know, there are things about the organism that we are, such as that we eat other organisms, whether we're vegetarian or not, we eat other organisms. There's certain things about what we're like as organisms, and that includes that we compare, that we judge, that we think, that we have this illusion of self, that we have illusions of choice and free will, and we have all these illusions. And it seems to me that that's okay with the perspective that it's not relevant to reality itself, to nature itself, to mind. So we can forgive ourselves for going about our business, you know, in awareness.
Uh-huh. I'm not quite sure how to respond to that. I mean, it's a very important function of mindfulness practice is to see what we actually do. See what, how it's actually going on within us and around us, through the non-filter, the filter of non-evaluative awareness, non-reactive awareness. So for judging ourselves or judging others, that's judgment. Judging is a very powerful aspect of our lives. Be able to see that without criticism and aversion or coming to conclusions about what that means about me, and to see that in this kind of way you're talking about, this is nature, 5 billion years of evolution has come down to this moment of judging. Great. It's just nature doing its thing. But see what's actually being meant by the word. Some of the values and some of the assumptions going into judgments are acquired and conditioned by society around us, and can be a kind of a delusion. Judgment usually means assigning of worth. Prajna is sometimes translated into English as discriminating wisdom. The wisdom is able to discriminate, differentiate between things. This is one thing and this is another thing. Once we're able to differentiate between things, which is a very important part of practice, we want to be very careful to the assigning of worth to it. Is it good or bad, for example, or is it worthy or not worthy, or is it, the differentiation itself. And when we look at judgments, at judging, and it brings us suffering, then we don't want to be too tolerant of it. We want the capacity to see it clearly for what it is, but we don't necessarily want to tolerate it. We don't want to have aversion to it, but we don't want to just say, okay, well, this is the way human beings are, so I'm going to go along, I'm going to continue suffering things that we can just maybe become freer of. And one of the ways to do that for some people is to begin questioning is to question more deeply what is the function of that judgment, those judgments. And if we start asking ourselves what's the function of it, and not take it for granted, then you often find that underneath that judging, that it has some kind of function, trying to accomplish something for the person. And more often than not, it tends to be a form of self-protection. And then the person goes in and actually looks behind the judgments to the movement of self-protection and fear that might be behind it, and then goes further, and what's the function of that? Then they can slowly begin to kind of soften the grip of judgments and hopefully become free of it. So I don't quite know, what to do with what you said, except to say that what I said, which is I'd rather not that you be too accepting of your judgmental nature.
Okay, that's judgment itself.
What I said?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a judgment. Is it a judgment?
All I think is that certain things are going to be unpleasant to me. I studied for a little while with torture. That was 9 months ago.
Uh-huh.
And on the one hand, in awareness, I actually know that are no better or worse than myself. Nobody. And that is from the perspective of the awareness of the awareness of reality. On the other hand, the way the sort of who I am means that I'll probably do whatever I can to stop that.
Right, right.
Probably act as if that's a bad thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What you're saying, there's
reality, and there's who I am.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and there's some wisdom. I think there's a lot of wisdom and nobility in what you're pointing to. But it seems to me maybe it's a little more complicated than it needs to be. That's so. Anyway, so we should probably stop since it's over now, and ourselves to the ticking of the minute hand. So I thank you all, and This might be a little theme for a few, the idea of conceit, because there's a lot to explore here. At least tomorrow night, Monday night, I was thinking maybe either talk about politics or talk about conceit. Yes.
Just recently, I'm only touching upon this, but that often I find behind my own judgments and even comparisons, but mostly judgment is a feeling that I don't like, sadness or maybe anger or whatever, but that the judgment is sort of the step that I put on top of those just wrong feelings by themselves. And part of my practice has been to just allow the feeling itself rather than for me taking the next mind step of applying judgment.
Beautiful. Yeah, very beautiful. So thank you, and if this was useful today, then take it with you, and if it wasn't, leave it here.